Okay, so I'm going to move on to chapter 2, but just wanted to pause for a second and say that throughout the book, which is 30 chapters, there are 12 clippings, and a clipping is something that comes in between two chapters that is from a newspaper or some source in real life that also relates and connects to the story and the characters. So the clipping between chapter 1 and chapter 2 is a fun one. It's Ellie's puttanesca recipe, because Ellie and Annika are eating puttanesca together in chapter 1. So it's the recipe, and I'm not going to read the recipe. And I may not read all the clippings, I probably won't, but I'll certainly tell you what they are. And I was also thinking I could do a little better with my reading. I was listening to chapter 1 and I don't know, my pacing, I don't know. I could just going to try and do a little better. Okay, so here we go. Chapter 2, Ellie, Friday, January 11th, 2019, Berkeley, California. Ellie drove past the stately Claremont Hotel, the historic wedding cake sentinel that did double duty as iconic resort and southeast gateway to the UC Berkeley campus, referred to as simply Cal. Lit gloriously against the inky January evening and shadowy foliage, it was a welcoming foray to Piedmont Avenue, which was lined with many elegant, and some tired, sorority and fraternity houses. Campus was quiet, with many students still returning from holidays before the winter school term began. There was little rhyme to the architecture of the mansion houses constructed originally as manor homes for their previous wealthy owners, now housing the brightest and best students from all over the world in shared conclaves. They passed a student in a Golden Bears Cal hoodie, having just stepped off the AC transit bus outside the International House at the intersection of Bancroft and Piedmont, her large roller suitcase standing, handled to the sky on the sidewalk. Ellie thought how her whole life was ahead of her and suppressed an impulse to lower the window and shout to her, "Stay free!" Usually when Ellie drove these streets, a serenity washed over her, for it was here that she had spent some of her happiest days without realizing it at the time. It was on the north side of Berkeley and campus that she had lived with Enzo and Genevieve, and where she and her father Stanley, now beside her in the front passenger seat, had grown up. But today, there was no calm to be had. Today, her stomach swirled in a charcoal pit of sorrow. By the time she'd reached Alta Bates Hospital yesterday evening, sped through the seafoam green painted corridors, past the nurse's station, towards Enzo's room, only to feel an urgent grabbing and hand pulling her back, she knew. She was too late. "Miss Benvenuto," cried the nurse. Ellie had spun on her heels to face the Filipina nurse, who now had a firm grip of her. Ellie caught a glimpse of her name tag, Marisol. "I'm sorry, Miss Benvenuto. He's gone. I can tell you, he went peacefully." Marisol's voice had the compassionate cadence of someone practiced in doling out bad news to loved ones. Ellie had stared blankly at her for a moment while Marisol took a step back and gently dropped Ellie's arm. "He's gone?" said Ellie, her voice a whisper. Marisol nodded. "I'm very sorry," she said. "Let me come in with you. He went just a short time ago. We were with him, Miss Benvenuto. He was not alone." How long was a short time? 10 minutes? Half an hour? Ellie had raced here as fast as she could, cursing the cement truck and closed lane that held her up on the Bay Bridge, swollen with rush hour traffic. In shock, Ellie had allowed Marisol to bring her into the room where Enzo lay, a white sheet pulled the whole way over his head. When the nurse carefully folded it down, it looked as though he were just sleeping. He even seemed to be smiling. Ellie had reached for his hand, but already the warmth had begun to cool. It was then that she had broken down. When she'd recovered somewhat, Marisol left her to sit with Enzo, and Ellie had taken out her phone to call her father. 3 missed calls. Dang it! She hadn't paired her phone with the Honda she'd bought after she and Joe divorced, because she wasn't a fan of phone distractions, hands-free or otherwise, while responsible for 2 young lives in the back seat. Ellie rebuked herself now. If she'd done so, she would have gotten Stanley's earlier calls and made it in time to be there for Enzo, who'd always been there for her. She tapped the icon on her phone to call her father back. "Dad," sputtered Ellie through her tears. I know, he said, his voice also cracking. I know. They called me. For the next hour, while Ellie sat beside her beloved grandfather's still body, she thought in that moment how she had never quite felt so alone. Now, Enzo and Genevieve were both gone. They'd been so much more than figureheads, as she had spent her formative college years living with them in their small three-bedroom house on LeConte Avenue. They'd been protective and encouraging, always so proud of her, sizing up her college boyfriends for her and putting up with her moodiness while she was studying for the law school entrance exam. Sizing up college boyfriends for her and putting up with her moodiness while studying for the law school entrance exam. And she had been in more physical contact with them due to their location and care needs than her own parents who lived in Chicago over the past two decades. Her father, who checked flights as they spoke, would not land until the next day, Friday. She typed a short, to-the-point email to her brother Leo, who was an environmental engineer working on projects all across sub-Saharan Africa and was notoriously difficult to contact. Joe would be understanding through this and look after the boys when she needed, but that shared intimacy of being there for her was long gone. She tapped her phone favorites and hit Annika's number to relay the news. I'm so sorry, said Annika, while Milo called in the background. What a blow. My heart hurts for you, Elle. I know what he meant to you. By the time she got back from the hospital, the children were zonked out on the sofa in Annika's flat, and together they lifted the boys into Ellie's and put them straight into bed, peeling off their clothes and finding pajamas without switching the lights on. Ben had been in the shower, and Ellie was relieved she didn't have to make conversation about what had just happened. In her living room, Annika embraced her tightly. Thank you, said Ellie. Thank you for everything. Try to get some rest, said Annika sympathetically. I put a bowl of puttanesca in your fridge. I know you won't feel like eating, but it's there, and it will keep a couple days. Ellie smiled. They shared keys to each other's homes. Some days it seemed their shared coming and going was what held everything together. Well, I gotta pause for a second. After a fitful night of sobbing and reliving memories of both her beloved grandparents, Ellie rose for work that morning, eyes red-ringed and puffy. She felt as if she hadn't slept at all. She would go in, sort out some casework, and leave early to allow for Nathan's punctual pickup and Stanley's from the airport. His flight was due that evening, according to his early morning text message, always in caps and always signed Love Dad, despite her repeated instruction that texts didn't require a sign-off. She was relieved it was Friday and she would have the weekend to spend with her father while they attended to all too familiar end-of-life affairs, having dealt with the loss of her grandmother less than a year ago. Stanley was chatty when she picked him up, leaving out no detail about his flight snacks, about friends of his at the Chicago Curling Club, about a plumbing problem at the house, about their dog, a golden retriever named Dogzilla, who Stanley complained was completely irresponsible for the countless tennis balls he failed to retrieve and who had arthritis. Ellie figured he was filling the space with banality to save them talking about what was really happening. She could not bring herself to join his upbeat patter and responded with neutral hmms and ahs. She felt exhausted and emotional and was glad Joe had taken the boys early for the weekend. At LeConte Avenue, they pulled up in front of Enzo's two-story brown shingled house, in somewhat disrepair from years of weathering. It pained Ellie to see the house in darkness, knowing Enzo would never come home again. As they walked up the path, the winter overgrowth pushing past the edges of the stepping stones, Ellie held her key out and watched her step. The door was sticky and a stagnant smell greeted them, the odor of a house unaired and unlived in, when she pushed it open. Enzo had been in the hospital for only a week, and yet the house already groaned in his absence. Stanley set his carry-on spinner suitcase in the front hall and moved through the house, switching on lights. Perhaps he, too, felt the sense of wretched loneliness and lack of light. Ellie put the kettle on the stove and dug through the powder-blue painted kitchen drawer where she remembered Genevieve kept an assortment of tea that she suspected was still stashed there. Enzo was strictly a coffee man, but Genevieve had loved to drink black tea and now, even though she normally avoided caffeine, decided that tonight was different. Tonight, she needed the boost. Ellie sat on the saggy sofa while Stanley ran his hands over Enzo's eminent black leather recliner, finally sinking himself into the throne from which his father ranted over many a Cal versus Stanford football game. They sipped from their steaming cups in silence for some moments. "Well," said Stanley brightly, "looks like I'm an orphan now." "Dad," protested Ellie. "Not helpful." Yet they both chuckled. It was a moment of levity amidst their murky grief. "I feel so sad," admitted Ellie. "It's like a sharp stone in my guts." "I know," her father agreed. "It is sad, but he had a long life. We're all only here temporarily." He seemed comfortable speaking only in platitudes. "I can't believe I didn't get to say goodbye," bemoaned Ellie, finally admitting her guilt. "If I'd just checked my phone earlier or had it connected with my car like it should have, I should have been there with him in the end, but he died alone, without any of us, in a sterile hospital." Tears brimmed in her eyes again. They seemed to be hanging there all day, her grief like the sword of Damocles, threatening to crush her spirit on repeat. "You know, Ellie," Stanley shared, "my grandfather died on a hospital bed, and I did make it in time to say goodbye. He was already 1 foot in the next place and mumbling about camping in Golden Gate Park and Enrique Caruso singing opera. I'm not even sure he knew I was there, and I can tell you this much. It didn't make it any easier. You can't beat yourself up. Look, I wasn't even in the same city as he was. Wait, hold on. I wasn't even in the same city, and he was my dad. That's life. Your nonno's looking down on us right now, I betcha, saying, 'Hey, that's my seat. What are you doing drinking tea?'" They chuckled again. Her father was an upbeat person. It was nice to see him, even if the circumstances were bleak. "You'll be okay to stay here?" she asked, even though she knew the answer. Stanley would prefer his childhood home to her tumultuous, child-dominated flat. "Sure," said her father, "just like old times." After Genevieve had died, Stanley had stayed with Enzo in the house, too. Neither of them had expected he would be back to stay again in a similar circumstance in such a short time. "We're lucky he wasn't a hoarder," said Ellie. "I mean, the place is pretty tidy, right?" "Looks like that lady you hired was doing a good job," said Stanley. "She wasn't his housekeeper, Dad, but yeah, Thais took good care of him." She had called Thais to tell her of Enzo's death last night, and both felt guilt and relief when the caregiver told her how shocked she was, and she had only been to visit Enzo that morning in the hospital. The last kindly visitor Enzo had, whom he'd known just a short time. The tears overwhelmed, and Ellie let out a wet, mournful sob. Her sudden outburst made her father flinch. "Ellie Belly," he said, joining her on the sofa and rubbing her shoulders. "I'm sorry, Dad," she said. "I know you don't need this. I'm just really upset." "Aw," offered her father tenderly. There was nothing more he could say. He let her cry, still patting her back. When she had composed herself again, pulling a Kleenex from her sleeve just like Genevieve used to do, her father confessed he'd been worrying about her. "You've had a tough year," he frowned. "First your nonna, then all the business with Joe." Ellie groaned. She did not want to talk about her divorce. "And then, of course, that job of yours and all the trouble with that law firm." Ellie stiffened. She really didn't want to discuss that either. "Have you done anything about it?" he said gingerly. "You really should, you know. I've been thinking about it a lot. I know you're the lawyer, and I know you know this business, but I was reading a case in the New York Times the other day about a woman who was forced out of her job and..." "Dad," Ellie interrupted and stood from the couch. "I really don't want to talk about it, okay?" She sniffed loudly and squared her shoulders. "And besides, you're right. This is my business. I know what I'm doing." "I know you do," he said. "But sometimes you can't see the woods for the trees. When it's your own situation, sometimes things need pointing out." "Dad," Ellie pleaded, feeling the panicked sense of her heart dropping to her stomach. Stanley held his hands up in defeat. "Okay, okay, Elle, but listen. Maybe think about coming back to Chicago with me for a little break? We could bring the boys to see their grandma. I'll pay for the tickets." The thought of packing up the boys, and Luca in particular, made Ellie feel even more drained. "Martin Luther King holiday is next weekend, and my return flight is Friday," Stanley noted. "Don't you get an extra day off at that supposedly family-friendly nonprofit that I'm sure underpays you?" He sighed, and Ellie could see how gray and weary he was in the face. You look really tired, said Ellie. Traveling takes it out of me. I'm beat, he conceded. Why don't you go to bed? I'll come back in the morning and bring breakfast. All right, Elle, said her father. Suddenly, Ellie felt desperately weary, too. Part of her wanted to go up to her old room, get under the blankets, and close her eyes. She felt that here she would dream of her nonno and nonna. Here she could be close to them. Here, sleeping, it would be as if they were all still under one peaceful roof. Ellie returned the following morning with fresh bear claw pastries from Nabalam Bakery. She knew Stanley's weak spot for a really legitimate bear claw, as he put it, and her mother, Simona's, mission to keep him from such temptations. But now was a time for comfort for everyone. She and Stanley needed to organize next steps for most immediately Enzo's cremation and honoring his additional final wishes. Enzo hadn't mentioned the whereabouts of key documents, such as a last will and testament, bank and investment accounts, and the like, so they had some hunting to do. Ellie turned on the stove again, this time for the mocha pot, and scanned the quaint kitchen with its faded wallpaper of fruit baskets and beige speckled formica countertops. Her eyes paused at sentimental objects of her grandparents' life, the blue spode Italian ceramic serving trays Genevieve had used for holiday dinners, the hand-painted tea set Enzo had brought back to Genevieve from Japan after World War II, the heavy marble mortar and pestle passed down through generations and reputedly originating from Carrara, Italy. Enzo had few of the modern conveniences she had in her flat, like the instant hot water tap. Her grandparents had only capitulated to a microwave when she'd brought one home during her first year of college, telling Genevieve it didn't make sense to keep a single plate of dinner warm in the oven for her. She had lobbied for a modern electric coffee maker, but Enzo wouldn't hear of it, a pure devotee of his stovetop mocha pot. All an automatic machine produces is brown water, Enzo had insisted. Too quick, not enough contact of water with the coffee grounds. This from a man who had roasted and ground his own beans. Finding a spray bottle of cleanser, she wiped down all the countertops, and when done in the kitchen, she moved into the living room and began to swab the shelves as peachy rays of morning sun sliced through the opening in the drapes. As often happened when she was upset, Ellie found that cleaning soothed her agitated mind. It provided instant gratification of reward to effort. Stanley busied himself rifling through the sideboard and chest drawers in search of Enzo's personal documents. Pausing to pick up a photo of Enzo and Genevieve smiling inside a silver-plated frame, Ellie hugged the photo to her chest. It was such a sweet picture of two people who seemed truly in love. They would need an image for the online announcement of Enzo's death. Maybe this one would do. Ellie placed the picture back on the shelf next to the leather-bound, gilt-edged, illustrated two-volume set of Enzo's favorite book, The Count of Monte Cristo, which he would ask Ellie to read regularly to him after dinner as he'd relaxed with a pipe and a glass of homemade limoncello in his great black leather recliner. She smiled again, remembering those cozy moments and their animated discussion over what Enzo revered as the OG of superhero stories, and noticed a large wooden box protruding from the bottom shelf. She recognized it from the attic when she would help Genevieve haul out Christmas decorations. It was years since she'd seen it, and she'd never even looked inside it. What was it doing here in the living room? Had Enzo lugged it all the way down the retractable attic stairs? She had, after all, pulled her car in front of the house this past year to catch him in the act of shakily ascending a ladder to clean his rain gutters. He shouldn't have done that. Is that what caused the attack that landed him in the hospital? Didn't he ask Thais for help? Ellie's mind was spiraling again. She squeezed her eyes to avoid another onslaught of stinging tears. She tossed the dust rag over her shoulder and eased the box out from its position onto the floor, leaving a rectangular space of pristine mahogany, showing just how much dust had accumulated on the shelves. She took the cloth and wiped around the box space before running her palm over the lid of the box, feeling the smooth curve of the material, almost like satin. Was it rosewood? It was heavy with the bearing of a treasure chest, as if housing precious and valuable contents. Intrigued, she lifted the lid and, sitting crisscrossed on the rug, saw that it was filled with a potpourri of possessions. Ellie carefully shuffled through the stacks of news clippings, a collection of antique pipes, a small mother-of-pearl-handled magnifying glass, an intact pocket watch with a patina at the edges, and a pouch made of some animal hide. Scattered photographs and letters lay beneath other items she didn't even recognize. She lifted out a large wooden contraption in the shape of a pie wedge. It was a splintered, rickety sextant with levers inside a crossbow shape and looked like something Galileo might have used. Beneath the sextant was a large ridged rock, the color of the caramel swirl Fenton's ice cream Genevieve used to serve on Sundays after lunch. Examining it, Ellie thought it actually resembled some sort of giant molar. She wondered if it was a fossil. Where had all this stuff come from? And all the time she'd spent in that house over conversations with her grandparents, she had never been shown these artifacts and family memorabilia. Underneath the rock was a gauzy swatch of faded fabric with a Native American design, as best she could discern from the textiles she'd seen in Anika's flat. It was handmade by the looks of it and very, very old. Ellie unraveled it to find a long, skinny, sharp metal rod, almost like a skewer, at the end of which was some sort of red hourglass-shaped ornament engraved with the letter T. She had absolutely no idea what the instrument was used for. A type of letter opener? Miniature campfire poker? Extra-long toothpick? Sifting through the black and white photographs and daguerreotypes, she inspected the faces, imagining she noticed some tawny-complected family resemblances to Nathan and Luca. A saddle-brown, soft leather-bound notebook caught her eye, and she lifted it from the bottom of the box and ran her hands over the smooth, worn cover. She opened it to find a handwritten inscription, the writing childish with large loops and curves in the cursive script. The Diary of Theodora Mary Ellis, Boston, Massachusetts, 1867. Private. Wait, what? Theodora Ellis? Ellie knew that name from somewhere. She'd seen it on the family tree that Stanley had painstakingly scribed some years back, although no one had ever mentioned her that she could remember. Theodora was Ellie's great-great-grandmother. Ellie's skin prickled. Sitting with her back to the orange and brown tweed couch, Ellie turned the first yellowed page and began to read.